Welcome to China in Focus. I'm Paul Graney, in for Tiffany Meyer. Our top story. A new Pentagon report warning China is ramping up military pressure on Taiwan. It also says Beijing is making advancements in quantum computing, even as corruption inside its military raises serious questions about readiness. China slapping sanctions on 20 U.S. firms and 10 executives following Washington's largest arms sale to Taiwan. We break down what the sanctions mean. Japan has approved a record $58 billion defense budget for the coming year, aiming at strengthening its military capabilities amid rising tensions with China. And as the year comes to a close, we take a look back at how Congress has tackled the threat posed by the Chinese Communist Party. The Pentagon says China is preparing to take Taiwan by 2027. A new 100-page report details how Beijing is beefing up its forces, strengthening military capabilities away from the mainland, and investing in nuclear capabilities. It says China's buildup is changing the balance of power in the Indo-Pacific. The Pentagon says it's likely the Chinese regime recently loaded more than 100 nuclear-capable missiles into launch silos in northern China. These are ballistic missiles capable of reaching the United States. The Pentagon calls it part of a massive, long-term nuclear expansion. China reportedly has more than 600 nuclear warheads and wants 400 more by 2030. The U.S. has far more, over 5,100. Taiwan makes up a big part of the Pentagon's new report, that is, Beijing's preparations to invade the island. In 2024, China simulated landing operations, long-range strikes, and even a maritime blockade. Beijing is also stepping up military pressure on the island. Incursions into Taiwan's air defense are up over 60%, and Chinese warships are operating more frequently in the Taiwan Strait. Meanwhile, China's navy continues to grow. It just completed sea trials of its third aircraft carrier, the Fujian. It uses advanced launch technology just like U.S. carriers. China aims to launch 6 more aircraft carriers by 2035, bringing its total to 9. By comparison, U.S. law requires the Navy to maintain 11 carriers at all times. The Pentagon's report warns that China's military is betting on quantum computing. Analysts say a breakthrough here would give Beijing a big advantage on the battlefield, a capability that could rival the effectiveness of aircraft carriers or fighter jets. The report also highlights how China is trying to recruit foreign scientists to gain an advantage in artificial intelligence and other technologies that could be used in war. However, it notes several weaknesses in the regime's military, for example, poor quality equipment and corruption. The Pentagon says corruption-related investigations have led to the removal of dozens of generals. And the Chinese regime slapping sanctions on 20 American defense firms and 10 company executives. The move comes after Washington approved an $11 billion arms sale to Taiwan. Now, targets on China's blacklist include Boeing's St. Louis branch, Northrop Grumman, and the founder of Anduril Industries. Now, under the sanctions, these firms or individuals would have their assets in China frozen and be barred from doing business with Chinese companies. The executives on the blacklist are also banned from entering China. And Japan's cabinet on Friday approving a record defense budget plan for the coming fiscal year. The $58 billion budget aims to boost defense capabilities as tensions with China increase.
Japanese Prime Minister Sane Takeuchi said in November that her country's military could get involved if China were to take action against Taiwan. The spending increase marks the fourth year in Japan's five-year program to double defense spending to 2% of GDP. Under U.S. pressure, Japan's pledge to reach the 2% mark will arrive 2 years earlier than planned. Japan also plans to revise its security and defense policy by December 2026 to further strengthen its military. The current strategy names China as the country's biggest strategic challenge. It also calls for a more offensive role for Japan's self-defense force under its security alliance with the U.S.
And as we enter the end of the year, let's take a look back at one of the most vital subjects that Congress is working to address, the threat of the Chinese Communist Party. NTD's Washington correspondent Jack Bradley has more on the moves Congress has made to stand up to the CCP over the past year.
The Chinese Communist Party presents the greatest threat to American values and American national security in our lifetime.
Congress has taken some strides this year to crack down on the Chinese Communist Party, and it's one of the few issues that we see bipartisanship in the legislature. In the most recent case, Congress's new $900 billion defense budget legislation prohibits the Pentagon from purchasing equipment from blacklisted Chinese biotech companies.
Well, there's a lot of things that the American government is using that they probably should not be using. It varies from everything from Chinese-made routers to drones. Hundreds of, maybe even thousands of apps that directly say that they're sending American data from your phone over to mainland China.
The Pentagon's budget also ramps up defense in the Pacific region to deter CCP aggression towards Taiwan.
Xi has ordered the People's Liberation Army to be ready to take Taiwan by force by 2027.
That's as the CCP is conducting the largest military buildup since World War II. And earlier this month, President Trump signed the Taiwan Assurance Implementation Act, requiring the State Department to update its guidelines for U.S. engagements with Taiwan at least every 5 years. And it's designed to deepen the relationship between the two countries in the absence of formal diplomatic relations. And earlier this year, members of Congress were calling out this hot mic moment between CCP leader Xi Jinping and Russia's President Vladimir Putin, where Xi says that one can live to 150 years old through continuous organ transplants. And that's while the CCP is engaged in forced organ harvesting.
We've heard some horrific stories of this organ transplants and all of this in China, that they take it from unwilling donors, okay, to put it mildly. And the fact that they were caught on a hot mic, first I've heard of that, is very telling. It tells you what their worldview is in contrast to ours, speaking of evil.
To address this, the House passed the Stop Forced Organ Harvesting Act and Falun Gong Protection Act in May, which would put sanctions on anyone facilitating the practice.
In China, there's no waiting list for organs. So what that means is there's a ready supply. There's a ready supply because they take them from healthy, living people, particularly these folks that practice the religion of Falun Gong.
Now, these are just a few of the several pieces of legislation that were passed in the House, but most continue to await action in the Senate. Reporting from Washington, D.C., Jack Bradley, NTD News.
And President Trump announcing plans to build a new class of battleships as China also expands and modernizes its military. But will the plan shift the balance of power in the Indo-Pacific? NTD's Melina Weisskopf spoke with retired Colonel Hal Kampfer for his take.
Colonel Kampfer, first of all, thank you so much for joining us, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays, Melina.
Colonel, as a former Marine intelligence officer, when you initially heard about the plans for the new Trump-class warships, what were your initial thoughts?
Well, it was an interesting warship. You know, the Navy shipbuilding program has had some real problems over the years. You know, they had the destroyer, the Zumwalt, class, and that didn't turn out too well. They had big plans, and I think they only built three of them. And then, of course, the littoral combat ships were kind of a disaster, and they didn't plan to go too well. And then, of course, the Navy just dropped its plans for a frigate, and they've decided they're going to instead get the Coast Guard's national security cutters and basically transfer them into a frigate. So this is obviously being looked at very closely because he's talking about building a brand new ship, a ship, you know, that wasn't currently planned, and he's planning on rolling it out very quickly. So there's a lot of concern, you know, that this we might be overreaching on trying to do this. With that said, it is an impressive ship. I don't know how much it's going to actually end up costing, but it is an you know, what they've shown so far, it has a lot of capabilities, some of which we haven't even developed yet.
Colonel, how do you think a ship like this could compare to the most advanced vessels fielded by China, for example? And do you think it would meaningfully change the balance of power in the Pacific?
Well, there'd have to be enough of them. China has a number of vessels. I'm a little skeptical of some of the capabilities. The Chinese always advertise that these ships can do amazing things, and I always find their rhetoric is much higher than their capabilities are. But But with that said, this is a very powerful, what's being advertised is coming out would be very powerful, but it's not coming out right away. China is getting ready to be able to launch what they say they're going to be able to launch, an amphibious invasion of Taiwan by as early as 2027. There's no way that this vessel's, even the first one, the USS Defiant, is going to be out by 2027 on the high seas. So they're saying maybe they'll have some out by 2030. There's two initially ordered. They say possibly 10 as a follow-on order. And then the thought is somewhere in the 2030s, we may have to get to 20 or 25 of these vessels. I think they could make a big difference in the South China Sea. However, I don't know what the strategic situation will be in the South China Sea by then. And certainly China has a tremendous shipbuilding capability. So whatever we're looking at now may not represent what they have 5 or 10 years from now.
How would these ships integrate with the Navy we already have, including all the carriers, submarines, and destroyers?
I think they'd actually work out fairly well. I think they could be, you know, they already have talked about they could be part of an aircraft carrier task force. They could be a standalone ship. And I think with the use of drones, variety of different types of drones, loitering munitions, and other things that are out there on the modern maritime battlefield or battle space, that the idea that we have to rely on an aircraft carrier that launches only manned aircraft, well, those days are kind of, they're not coming to an end, but they're definitely changing dramatically. So a ship that can launch a lot of different things, missiles, drones, and a variety of other things that, you know, that we haven't even developed yet in the laser category and the railgun category and some other things. Well, that tells me that it's a ship that has room for modifications to adopt modern technology. So it could be a very effective platform, could be a fairly survivable platform.
Now, why do you think rebuilding American shipbuilding capacity is strategically important, especially as competition with China is intensifying?
Oh, we basically lost our shipbuilding capability. At the end of the Cold War, we pretty much quit building ships for the most part. And we closed a lot of shipyards, naval shipyards around the country. At the time, there are many of us who were in uniform that thought this was rather a precipitous move, that we're going to regret this, and now we do regret it. The other thing that happened was we allowed the shipbuilding industry to essentially move overseas, and we didn't do those things necessary to protect our shipbuilding industry, to energize, to subsidize, or to keep our shipbuilding here on our shores. So now we're looking at building some categories of ships where we're actually looking at naval ships or Navy ships and Coast Guard ships where we're looking overseas to have them build it, because we just don't have the shipbuilding capability here. So now we're in this crash effort to try and rebuild our shipbuilding industry, but you don't build a shipyard overnight. It's going to take time, and it's going to take a lot of effort and a lot of resources.
Right, and we'll definitely be looking to see how this develops. Thank you so much for your time, Lieutenant Colonel Hal Kemper, for breaking this all down for us. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate your time.
And still to come, China reviving a strategic airfield near key Pacific islands, just 600 miles from Guam. NTD's Tiffany Meyer speaks with Indo-Pacific expert Cleo Pascal to break down the potential military implications. More on that after the break, here on China in Focus. Welcome back to China in Focus. I'm Paul Graney. Zooming out to the Pacific, China has been reviving an airfield on a chain of islands in Micronesia. What could that mean militarily for Guam, just over 600 miles away? NTD's Tiffany Meyer spoke with Cleo Pascal, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, to unpack the issue.
Cleo Pascal, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you back on the show.
Always a pleasure.
Now, diving right on in, satellite images plus your own on-the-ground reporting are showing that China, or a Chinese company, is trying to rebuild a World War II-era airfield. This is on a little place called Wuliai in the Pacific. First, talk to us about where exactly this is. How close is this to, say, Guam or the U.S.?
Sure. So Wuliai is an atoll in the state of Yap, which is part of the Federated States of Micronesia. It's about 600 kilometers, more or less, south of Guam. So it might seem like it's fairly remote, but as the missile flies, or as if you could fly a direct plane, it's maybe a little bit over an hour flight. It's a short runway, but the fact is that the Chinese could use it if they wanted, and if the local political environment was satisfactory, to launch drones or to base missiles. It is very, very close to Guam and in a direction that the Guam defenses aren't necessarily designed to look at.
Now, digging in here, this runway used to, I guess, belong to Imperial Japan and then, you know, kind of went under U.S. control, and then apparently it was underwater all the time, so kind of disappeared and went into, you know, misuse. Looking at China's side, though, pouring money in here, you know, China often says this when it does the Belt and Road initiatives or a lot in the Pacific Islands, it's helping the local economy, right, boosting the economy, jobs, all that. What is the concern here, though, about China, quote unquote, helping here?
Yeah, so first of all, this runway is essential. It's literally a lifeline for the people of Wuliai, but also for people from other parts of the island chain that aren't serviceable by plane. This was when the runway was operational. Pacific Mission Aviation, which is a missionary airline based out of Yap itself, could come in and do medevacs. Now, if you need to get off the island, first you have to wait for a boat, which comes maybe once a month, usually once a quarter often, and it's a four-day or five-day boat trip to the main island where the hospital is. So if you have a critical medical condition, you need a runway so that the plane can come in, pick you up, and take you to the hospital in a timely manner. So there's no question about that. But the Chinese ensured that the bidding was such that for this contract that they underbid by such a substantial degree that they were the only ones really that could get the footprint and build out the runway, develop the local relationships, and be the saviors of Wuliai, even though this was, again, funded by the national government. And of course, the national government itself is heavily funded by the U.S. So you can understand how grateful the locals are when the Chinese arrive and inaccurately say, we're building you a runway. They're just grateful not to have to take that darn boat for another week in order to get home to see their parents or go to high school or go to a medical appointment or anything like that.
Really quickly on that, should the U.S. be doing something similar, if you will, to China by pouring funds into infrastructure like this?
The U.S. absolutely should be. I mean, the state of Yap itself has a main island also called Yap. And in the current NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, there's $1.5 billion for the refurbishment of the runway and the taxiway on the main island. For a small fraction of that, the U.S. could be building out these facilities all the way up and down the chain, which would allow Pacific Mission Aviation to operate, which would allow the Peace Corps, for example, to come back. And the Peace Corps is incredibly valuable for the local population and for building up those soft power ties with the U.S. So by ceding these pieces of infrastructure and not getting ahead of it, I mean, there are no docks on any of these islands. If you are looking at a kinetic map, at a conflict map, all of these things have potential dual use. Now, I would argue that they should be dual use, primarily civilian from the point of view of the democracies, as opposed to dual use being set up for Chinese potential use. So yes, you're not only helping these people that you promised you would help through the Compacts of Free Association, but you're also expanding the ability to defend the islands in case of a conflict over Taiwan, because there's no question that they will be involved in case of a conflict over Taiwan, which is what President Panuelo, former president of the Federated States of Micronesia, put in his letters. He knows that what the Chinese are doing there is about Taiwan.
There is this CCP strategy called surrounding the cities from the countryside. Talk to us about that and how perhaps this runway fits into that strategy.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is very much what's going on. There's a filling in of these strategically unobserved or empty or not contested areas. The Chinese Communist Party will push on every door, but they'll also map in detail the relationships of people in the country. So somebody might be coming from Wuliai who has not flashed on the screen of the U.S. Embassy, but is related to somebody who may end up being president, for example. And the Chinese have detailed relationship mapping of who's important and who they're related to, and it's generational. You know, they'll invite people to China, learn all about them. I mean, we saw this with the president of Nauru, another small country, where they discovered that he had Chinese great-great-grandmother and brought him out to, or great-great, whatever it was, a woman ancestor from China, and brought him out to China to meet these discovered relatives of his in China. The U.S. has a different kind of way of operating. There's kind of in a place like Wuliai, because members of the Compacts of Free Association citizens can live and work in the U.S. and serve in the U.S. military, you'll have a lot of people on that island who have lived and worked in the U.S. or have relatives or who are veterans themselves who served in the U.S. military. So the principal of the high school did his training in the U.S. It's a much more genuine potential connection, but it's not the U.S. that's providing the runway. Is the Chinese are running circles around everybody in the narrative warfare domain. So they're saying when the U.S. comes to build infrastructure, it's militarizing the islands and it's making you a target. But when we come, we're just building civilian capacity. No, and there's nobody to counter it.
Cleo Pascal, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure. Thanks again.
And that's all for today's China in Focus. I'm Paul Graney. If you have any feedback on the show, maybe you'd like to see us cover something in particular, send us an email at chinainfocus@ntd.com. We'd love to hear from you. For around-the-clock original news coverage, visit us at ntd.com or download our NTD app. Thanks for watching. See you soon.